This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning. Are you looking to engage with regional decision makers, business leaders, elected officials, and industry professionals committed to improving downtown San Diego? Join the Downtown San Diego Partnership. As a member, you'll receive access to exclusive resources, exposure to special programming, networking functions, and additional opportunities unmatched by any other local membership-based organization. Join the driving forces behind the future of downtown San Diego. For a 10% discount, become a member today.
Should we do this?
Uh-huh. Sure. Okay. I'm just going to be so invested and dialed into what you're saying.
Good. Where's the phones even put aside?
Yeah.
Hey.
It's a new year.
It's a new year.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 KOGO. I am Scott Lewis, the CEO and Editor-in-Chief at Voice San Diego, and I'm joined, as always, by Andrew Keats, Managing Editor at Voice San Diego. What's up, Andy?
Scotty, what up?
Fellow Managing Editor Andrea Lopez Villafana. Feliz año.
What's up, Scott?
How are you?
Good.
Coming up on the show this week, the Mayor's State of the City speech is coming up. It's always a really great way to start the new year. So exciting for local politics nerds to hear what the mayor has to say. The big annual address sometimes includes big announcements. We'll try to predict what he'll say, including something like, quote, homelessness is a housing problem, which may seem controversial to some. We'll get into why it should be pretty straightforward. And finally, transitional kindergarten has changed education throughout California. Changed your life.
Has.
We'll talk about how parents, kids, and school districts are adapting to the new normal for California education and how the local school district thinks it might save it from some bigger problems it's been facing. That's all coming up. Stay with us. Before we get rolling, we have to say thank you. We did hit our goal for the year-end fundraiser, $250,000 from individual donors. Thanks, and it means a lot. Folks really stepped up this year, and that means a lot for our ability to pull things off this year, be able to make payroll and all that. So let's give a shout out to those who gave a shout out to us. Jennifer Roy, for example, she said, from the whistle to the conversations and informative content, VOSD is always my first choice. Hey, fantastic. Thank you, Jennifer.
Come write copy for us, Jennifer. That was good.
Yeah. Ink and Mellow, I love your podcast. Exclamation point. Fantastic. Love you. Great name. Corey Minotti said, Scott told me Nate, John, and Andy mentioned that Lopez wants me to, so I did. Other folks who gave us a shout out, Nicholas Hamilton, Laura Ravine, Michael McDonald, thank you so much. If you did not give last month, your gift still matters. Our fiscal year actually goes till June, and we need to get every dollar in we can. It all matters. So you can give now and drop us a note at vosd.org/podpeople, vosd.org/podpeople. Hey, no fault if you missed the end of the year deadline. Come on in. We got you. Just give you a shout out. The link is in the show notes. I don't know if you heard, but over Christmas, there was a lot of weather throughout the United States. We got caught up in it a little bit. We were in the mountains of Utah. Obviously, I grew up near there and used to driving in the snow. But there was one moment where we were driving through this very high mountain pass, and the minivan had chains on. Which chains are fantastic, very good grip, as good as any 4x4 I've ever driven. And you know what people get wrong about driving in the snow is they think, like, you know, you can go faster with a 4x4 with a four-wheel drive. But the problem with driving in the snow is not going.
It's stopping.
Yeah. And nothing about those big trucks helps you stop. In fact, the bigger they are, the harder they are to stop. And so we were cruising. We were doing great, except it got really bad, like really bad. And there was, you know, a good foot of snow on the ground, and then it became like a complete whiteout too. So when we were driving in, there was all these like sticks on the side of the road that we were like, wow, that's why are there sticks? Well, there are sticks there because when it's that snowy, you need to like stay between the sticks.
Ah.
And there, I looked over at my wife at one point and she was leaning forward in her seat and I have never seen her that stressed out in my life. And this includes like unexpected home births and stuff. Like this was a bad, stressful look that she had. And I was like, maybe my judgment will be questioned about what we're doing here. Maybe mm-hmm. things aren't going to work out very well.
Presumably that had already happened.
Right.
The judgment being questioned.
So I started getting, you know, white knuckled terror and I'm just like holding on, like doing our best. And I look in the rearview mirror and my daughter is just completely asleep. And at that moment I was like, that's good. That makes me
feel good. She trusts
you. Yeah. Just like that's just pure intrinsic trust.
Absolutely no sense of how little she should.
Right.
But she does.
Yeah. She's like, maybe if I sleep.
It's like he wouldn't put me in harm's way.
I won't notice what happens.
No, it's more than that. It just had never occurred to her that you would put her in harm's way to the extent that you did.
True. Now, that said, I did run into a snowbank. Ooh. And we did get briefly stuck. But I had been going slow enough that it wasn't a problem. I was able to get out of it.
Responsible.
But from this point forward, my family has used that as a joke against me now 75 times, maybe 80. Going to run us into a snowbank? Hopefully there's no snowbanks on the way. It's like, okay. But storms. Yep. There's a big one coming through San Diego and California right now.
It's here.
And they're calling it all kinds of things.
Has brought record rainfall, deadly flooding, and high winds to Northern California. A weather event known as an atmospheric river had dumped
it's
nearly...
It's not a hurricane or a tornado. It's called an atmospheric river. But what exactly is that?
Right. Do they say what it is?
Okay, so I have clicked on every news story and video that says... This is an atmospheric river. Are you curious what that is? Click here. I have clicked on all of them, and not one of them has done the job of explaining what the difference is between an atmospheric river and a storm. Like they'll go through like really long explanation. Well, water vapor evaporates from the ocean into the sky, and then it comes across the ocean, and it hits the mountains, and it rains. Well, that's what a storm does, too. That's a storm. You just described a storm.
A highly technical definition of a storm.
Yeah. And they're like, well, it has more water than the Amazon. Well, how many other clouds have a lot of water? I don't understand. It's like, well, it's water vapor. Well, they're all water vapor.
So you're not getting anywhere in terms of understanding if there is a distinction, or have you settled on the fact that it's just a storm?
I have decided that there's still probably, and I'm bracing for the, you know, Scripps Institute of Oceanography to call and be like,
here's what's
hey, dummy, you just embarrassed San Diego with your podcast.
Here's how it's different than a storm.
And it's fine, but it's a big storm. Yeah. with a big line of storm clouds.
But big storm and a big line of storm clouds does not sound as cool as atmospheric river.
Yeah, everybody goes to that. Like, it sounds cooler. I'm in.
it does sound cooler.
Now, does bomb cyclone sound better than atmospheric river?
Bomb cyclone sounds like parody. That sounds like what I would come up with if I was trying to make fun of the sort of perpetual game of weather inflation that we live through.
Yeah.
Weather channel inflation, I should
describe
say.
Describe weather inflation.
It's that... The ratings for the Weather Channel depend on panic and hysteria and chaos. And at a certain point, winter storm's not going to do it.
Right.
So it becomes a...
Blizzard.
A blizzard. And then a blizzard turns into a... What was that one?
Polar vortex.
Polar vortex, right. and now we've...
Polar vortex is good.
Yeah. And we've graduated now to atmospheric river and apparently to bomb cyclone. But bomb cyclone sounds... To me, like what The Onion would write if they wanted to just ridicule this phenomenon.
Have you survived the atmospheric river okay so far?
So far. It makes driving harder than it is usually.
Which is not something you need.
No. So I only drive during times when it's not raining.
Yeah. Now look, obviously, lots of rain in these areas. We live in a giant floodplain. I understand there's areas of San Diego, South Crest and others that deal with some severe flooding all the time. Don't want to minimize that. Take care. Hope you get what you need and the support you deserve. Just would love for one person to explain the difference between a storm and an atmospheric river. She moves her body like a cyclone, and she makes me want to do it all night long. Well, next Wednesday is the State of the City address for the mayor of San Diego. So Mayor Todd Gloria will give the annual address about where we're at and where we're going with the city. Often it's been a place where the mayors have announced, you know, big things like, hey, we're going to expand the convention center and pass a tax to do it, or we're going to build a new football stadium, all these things. You haven't been yet, huh?
No.
You haven't been to one before.
Sometimes it's a place to like roll out a music video that you've filmed with professional staff.
Yeah, let's do some highlights of the past. Yeah, so this was the best.
Worst
of the best of the worsts.
Yeah.
When former Mayor Jerry Sanders, to start the event, played a video, and it was this young black kid who was running. And it was a video of him running. Was it Lose Yourself?
It was Lose Yourself by Eminem.
Yeah.
He was running from like a southeastern San Diego neighborhood.
And he was looking, and somebody was getting like arrested, or there was some police presence going on.
Yeah.
He was running from that. So already it's a little problematic.
And then he ran to, I don't remember if it was first to downtown or first to Balboa Park. But the trajectory of his run was from his troubled neighborhood to the prosperous
downtown
neighborhood
that the mayor was going to
build.
Yeah, the mayor was going to see through, right? So the redevelopment of Balboa Park.
Yeah.
And then he ran, and then they ran past the part where they were going to build a new stadium, and it showed like the worst rendering of a Chargers stadium of all the 3,000 renderings of Charger stadiums that they did.
And like even a new convention center. Like,
yeah. And then
like a 12-year-old would be really jazzed about that.
Yeah. And then he runs past the convention center. All these places, by the way, that he would not be allowed to go or probably, you know, wouldn't have a reason to go to the convention or whatever. And then it came and everybody was like, wow, great video. And all of us were like, why did you do that? That was a really bad video. Like it basically said, your neighborhood is bad, but we're building a convention center.
Yeah, exactly.
and then it was juxtaposed the next couple of years with others who were,
you know, you say that out loud, and it's like
sounds terrible.
It's no surprise that Bob Filner won the mayorship that year on a neighborhoods first message,
downtown.
Running against downtown.
Right,
downtown was the enemy that he ran against, and like, yeah, he won. You know, with support like that coming from Sanders.
Yeah. I remember the year when also Jerry Sanders was giving it, and his press secretary, Fred Saines, who's now like the VP of communications at Apple, I think he was a big shot, and he would clap next to a microphone so that when the applause line started, he would, you know, kick it off by like sending this resounding applause through the whole, I think the most, I remember also when Kevin Faulkner, I think it was 2014 or 15, he...
Leakgate.
Yeah, Leakgate. So he, the Chargers were threatening to leave. And I got a hold of an advanced copy of the speech because we were all wondering what he would say about the Chargers. And the speech was just, we're going to form a task force. Which was hilarious, right? Like, oh, okay, another task force on this problem. And I reported that, and they were mad.
Yeah, they were very mad on the account of it had become standard practice that media would get an advanced copy of the speech that they would embargo and not report on. Now, Scott did not get an embargoed copy. He received it from a third party. We did not identify, but it was correct. Mm-hmm. And in response,
they fervently believed that you got it from another media member mm-hmm. who had agreed to an embargo mm-hmm. and that this was a workaround of sorts, which is not what happened. But then as a result, there were just no embargoed copies of speeches for the next few
really
years.
Mad.
They were really mad. It was as mad as they ever really were.
Right. So do you have any predictions about what he's going to say this time?
I would say, you know, the one thing I've noticed about Todd Gloria's two State of the City speeches, at least my impression of them, is that they have been much less than either Faulkner or Sanders were interested in. They have been much less interested in like outlining the year's agenda and making big announcements that were themselves news. The trappings of State of the City speeches have still been there, of course, but they seem less interested in creating a positive news cycle and more interested in almost like downplaying expectations almost. Mm-hmm. That's my read on what they've been doing.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. It's more about like explaining and talking about what they've achieved versus like outlining some broad vision. So if I'm to predict, he did put up a social media graphic with what he'd gotten done.
Yeah.
Hashtag getting it done in 2022. He said they passed a budget with the largest infrastructure investment. Here we go.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go. Increased homeless shelter capacity by over 40%. Okay. Signed an executive order directing stronger and prioritized enforcement of illicit fentanyl. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good signing. Updated the city's climate action plan, which, okay. It still doesn't like bridge the gap between the aspirations, the plan envisions, and what they are not and are doing, right?
Yeah, no, if anything, it extended the delta between those two things. Yeah.
Okay, but he did update it.
Right.
Okay. Passed Homes for All of Us Housing Action Package. Which one was that? This is like you can build more units around transit, stuff like that?
It was a number of things. Sort of like a renamed version of the land development code update.
Okay. Cool.
So there you go.
And this was my favorite. Received pro housing designation from the state. Good reception.
Yeah.
It's like a wide receiver.
Yeah.
Secured it. Good job.
Mm-hmm.
And then
advanced redevelopment of the sports arena.
There, advanced it. It's like getting a first down.
Mm-hmm.
If we're gonna keep that football metaphor. You got a first down.
Mm-hmm.
First.
Did not punt.
Didn't punt.
Yeah. I mean, like the one I think about the most was his first, where, you know, typically the start of a mayoral term, you have like or a presidential term or a gubernatorial term, you have first 100 days agenda where you're never going to have as much political capital as you do at the start. And you try to hit the ground running and lock up some early wins. Right. And part of this, I absolutely believe is genuine circumstance and not messaging or expectations management. But Todd's first State of the City was just about what a dire situation the city he inherited was in.
It was really a sharp elbow at his predecessor, like kind of surprisingly sharp.
Yes. And then also just about like dishing cold reality about the state of the pandemic.
Right.
And, you know, I remember talking to people at the time and saying like, well, look, you don't want to outline this bold agenda and there's no certainty that Congress is going to pass another tranche of COVID relief money. And if you don't get that COVID relief money, like there is no bold agenda and you're just going to be apologizing, backtracking right away. But of course, Congress did pass another tranche of relief money. And so those harsh budget realities that they were supposed to be facing in that first cycle and that second cycle just weren't there. You know, the budget got bigger, not smaller. And so it's interesting. So that's really what stands out. I can't think of a really major policy announcement that has come out from his State of the Cities, except perhaps last year at CARE Court. Mm-hmm. If you recall, that was, you know, he came out and said that he would be supporting, and that he was in conversation with the state about supporting an expansion of conservatorships that took people who could not fend for themselves because of their own mental health off of the street, and that that was a matter of compassion. And that did, the governor did end up supporting an expansion of care court, and that has passed. But a year later, I think it's safe to say that'll be a very marginal expansion in the size and scope of that project. Nothing that would even approach addressing not only most people who are living on the street, but even like not even a large fraction of the people living on the street.
Yeah, we deal with this a lot, right? Because they make it big. That was by far the biggest headliner out of that speech last year.
And insofar as that was a policy announcement, it carried through.
Sure.
The governor embraced it. He appeared with the governor. It's passed. It's law. It's coming this year.
But we see that a lot, right? Where it's like a big aspirational thing.
Yeah.
And then when you look into it and you're like, well, that's actually not going to change anything.
Or not going to change a lot.
A lot. And then they're like, well, we never said it would.
Yeah, we never said it would solve everything. There are no panaceas in politics.
But yeah. Like, well, we never said it was going to be a big deal. You did.
You did. And yeah.
It's like, it's always this dance between like them raising expectations, us pointing out that they didn't meet them, and then them saying, well, we never meant to.
Yeah.
It's like, well...
Yeah, okay. When it's announced as a big deal and we say that this might not be a big deal, we're cynical jerks. And then when it turns out that it's not that big a deal and we say, well, what about,
wasn't it going to be
a big deal? It's like, well, no, this is, you know, one of many, many things. And it's going to, you know, problem isn't going to be solved by one big thing. It's going to be solved by a million little things. And that may be true, but I do think that the trappings of a state of the city suggest otherwise. When you make a big policy announcement, it doesn't exactly suggest that this is one small step on the road to breaking down a big systemic problem.
Mm-hmm. So one thing that I'm sure he'll have to deal with, and this will be the biggest thing again that we look for, is the question of homelessness. How does he discuss it? There's been a lot of criticism this year. It's now by far a bigger deal and the biggest deal in the city. And people will be looking for what he has to say about it. And I'm almost certain it'll be a combination of all the things he has done, listing data like that, like the 40% shelter increase and you know, something maybe about enforcement. And then he'll say something about how it's a bad problem for the rest of the country too, and other major West Coast cities in particular. And then I bet he'll have a sentence that says something along the lines of, homelessness is a housing problem. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this is a thing that comes up a lot, where a lot of people, mostly on the conservative side, but not necessarily, say something like, no, this isn't, housing or homelessness is not a housing problem, and we need to stop talking about it like that. It's some sort of cultural or family or just individual failing, right?
It's a mental health problem. It's a drug problem. It's a crime problem.
Right. All those things.
Choose your thing. Yeah.
So I wanted to talk about that quickly. So they at the Regional Task Force on the Homelessness had a convention recently with people talking about the problem, and they brought in a speaker. Greg Colburn, he's from the University of Washington, and he wrote a book about this very topic. It's titled Homelessness is a Housing Problem. And I thought he did something really interesting in that. He looked at all of the cities in the country and their homelessness counts, right? They are all required to do this sort of census of homelessness. Mm-hmm. And he decided to like break it down. Okay, so if it's not a housing issue, why is it that some places have big homelessness problems and other places don't? And so he said, well, is it because of poverty? And he looked and the data is there, and there is no correlation between poverty and homelessness. Like, there are places with lots of poverty that don't have a homelessness crisis.
I grew up in one of those places.
Right. And then he said, what about mental illness? We always hear about it as a mental illness thing. So he looked at places with rates of mental illness and serious mental illness, and compared that to their homelessness count, and there was no correlation. So then he looked at drug use. This often comes up as well. Like, is it drug use? And he looked at the rates of drug use in certain areas, and there's places like West Virginia where there's tons of drug use and not homelessness like this. And so then he looked at substance use disorder and all these other, and tried to find, okay, is there any of these that correlate to that? No. But the one thing he could look at that did correlate with massive homelessness was the cost of living, and in particular, the cost of housing and rent and cost of land for homes, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so presumably what he declared is that in some other places, landlords are less greedy than the landlords here.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And he found out that, yes, in Chicago, they're just like letting people
they're
live.
Just like, they're well, like, we just decided to take less profit.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing he brought up. He's like, well, what about, so a lot of people say, well, Democrats are overseeing these cities that have tremendous homelessness problems, and that must be why. And he said, well, there's cities that have Democrats who have been in charge for a long time that don't have this problem either.
Right. Right,
Illinois and Chicago, and Cleveland,
And
so he found that actually it turns out that if you live in a place where it's very hard to make rent, it's actually got a higher rate of homelessness. And I think we've talked about these numbers before, but it really is crazy how much it costs to live here and how much that has gone up. The rents are too damn high.
Yeah, the statistic I just saw that. Eric Bruvold, who works for the North County EDC, was that currently right now over half of households spend over half of their income on housing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's crazy. But and the rule of thumb forever has been like a third of your budget should be on housing.
I think when you think about it that way, it's like it just, and so many stories that we've heard that Lisa reported and, you know, other stories we've heard, it's like it just takes one bad thing
right
to happen to you for you, like lose your job or something, and then you're basically on the street.
And then you get into a position, and I'm trying to learn about this as much and more too, is which if let's say you do fall out of the housing market, out of the rental market, you're couch surfing, whatever, to get back in is a lift. Mm-hmm. Like let's say you're trying to get back into a $2,000 a month apartment. First you got to find it. Then you have to come up with the security deposit. We're talking like $10,000 you need to have available, plus good credit to be able to get that foot back in the door. And then a lot of people say, well, they should just move. Well, you have to do the same thing if you move to Phoenix or Utah. It's not like people are there waiting for you to like, hey, come on in. Like, we got you.
Harder to get a job in a place you don't live.
And you don't know anybody, and it's unfamiliar, and you may not even know how to get there, like or what to do. I did, I finally pulled together something I'd want to look at. And this comes off of something you did a few years ago about the housing crisis, right? Like where you looked at just the job growth versus homes, whether the homes had kept up with jobs, right?
Yeah, over like 40 years.
It was like 2 years ago, was it?
Might have been three.
I don't know.
Because the slow, inexorable march of time has taken its toll on us all,
so,
me especially.
Thanks to Sandag and Stacy Garcia at Sandag, I got together some numbers, and I pulled a couple others together to make this very simple comparison. So in the year 2000 and then compared to the year 2020, right? So we have between 2000 and 2020, we have 220,000 more jobs. We have in 2020 compared to 2000. So over 20 years, we had basically 10,000, 11,000 more jobs created every year. 220,000 new jobs. Over that same period from 2000 to 2020, we created 176,000 new housing units. Mm-hmm. Like right there, you see that dramatically, right? I mean, sure, that's maybe oversimplified, but we created far more jobs than we created homes. And when you create far more jobs than you create homes, you're going to create a very tight housing market.
Yeah.
And a lot of people say, well, you know, this apartment building that's being built isn't going to serve the need, right?
Yeah.
But if you create a biotech job where the guy's getting paid or the woman's getting paid $150,000, they're going to find a place to live.
Yeah.
that money will be spent. They are going to find a place for that money.
If it's not in Carmel Valley, it might be in University City. If it's not in University City, then they might have to go to North Park.
Or Kearney Mesa.
Right. And if they find a place in North Park, then they're probably going to add to the demand for those homes there, and that's going to float the price of those homes there. Yeah. And and then people who want to find a place there who make a little less money, they're going to have to find a place somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Right. Barrio Logan. And Barrio Logan is suddenly going to have more demand than it had before, and that's going to raise the price and the value of the homes there. And it's going to go down all the way to the point where there's the very bottom where there's somebody whose rent is going to go up from $1,400 to $2,200 a month. They can't make it work and they end up homeless.
Yes.
Now, that is all very simplified. And everybody who sees somebody, and the vast majority of the people we run into on the streets a lot of the people run into on the streets, and it's easy for them to say, like, obviously this is a mental health crisis because I just saw a guy who did X, Y, or Z or whatever. But I think it helps to understand, like, well, yeah, we don't know how he got there. And it is a housing problem. But also that doesn't leave it so that we just don't do anything from that point, right? Yeah, it might take 3 years for the sports arena or whatever else the mayor's going to lay out that's going to create housing here to catch up to the need. But I think it's okay to also be insistent that in the meantime, what are we going to do? Because this is bad.
Yeah. I mean, a problem 20 years in the making. You know, we will not be building that 60,000 gap of homes that you just laid out in the next 3 years. That's just not, that's not how that goes. Keeping in mind, we need to keep pace with the new jobs we're creating every single year still.
Right.
You know?
It's
not like we stopped creating jobs. We very much do not.
Everybody pause. Yeah. Slow down.
Well, and there are people who offer that as a solution.
Let's stop
offering economic opportunity here, and the problem will take care of itself. And that's true in a certain way. It's just cruel in another way.
And bleak,
yes.
And I think goes back to the history, frankly, of this entire city, right? There's been this debate for a long time. Do we try to create wealth and industry here, or do we stop it because we want to keep it all nice and cozy? Mm-hmm. We are going to take a quick break. Stay with us.
Are you looking to engage with regional decision makers, business leaders, elected officials, and industry professionals committed to improving downtown San Diego? Join the Downtown San Diego Partnership. As a member, you'll receive access to exclusive resources, exposure to special programming, networking functions, and additional opportunities unmatched by any other local membership-based organization. Join the driving forces behind the future of downtown San Diego. For a 10% discount, become a member today.
So I'm sure you guys have noticed that our education reporter, Jacob McWinney, has been crushing it lately, writing a lot of stories about universal transitional kindergarten.
Rolls right off the tongue.
Yeah, UTK.
Yeah.
So basically, the state said 4-year-olds should go to public school, and they set up, you know, a time frame for when school districts should do that in the state of California. San Diego Unified said, hey, we're just going to do that now and start letting in all 4-year-olds into our schools without any restrictions on age and time frame for then their birthdays and such.
Right. Well, it used to be you could get into that program if you were born between September and December, which was a weird discrimination based on when you copulated and not like based on any other factors except when you
It was based on other factors. It was based on a presumption that those people would have been the youngest in their grades, and that this was creating a program for the people who were in this weird between about what grade they should be.
No, I remember. So my daughter was born at the end of December, so she missed this period, and she was really mad about it. She wanted to go to school so bad. That was before the pandemic when she liked school.
Okay.
And I remember she was walking home with me and she's like, can you just tell them to let me in? And I was like, no.
And she said, well, can you talk to the chalkboard guy? And I was like, I don't know what you mean. Aww. The chalkboard guy. And we were like really at a standoff. She's like, no, the chalkboard guy. And I was like, do you mean the school board guy?
Oh.
And she goes, yes, yes, yes. And I said, well, the school board guy doesn't like me. So
yeah. It's very perceptive of her. She picked up some adult conversations that she had overheard.
Yeah. And she, so she didn't get in. But yes, so that was the period. So now it said like everybody can go in. That had a lot of consequences for preschools who use four-year-olds to make the money they need to subsidize the rest of their operations. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about that later. But yeah. Jacob found that it was benefiting the school district for a number of reasons.
Yeah. But also to go back, it wasn't that these kids weren't going to school, right? They were going to schools where their parents were paying for them to go to school.
I think some of them probably didn't go to school.
Yeah, they might have been at home daycare or something.
Home daycare, yeah.
But yeah, like a preschool. Yeah.
Before we get on with some of the things Jacob's been doing, now that transitional kindergarten was a sensible name when it was available to a few people, and was meant to be a bridge between the, you know, preschool programs that are often offered and kindergarten. It was a transition to kindergarten. Now that it's universal transitional kindergarten, we might go ahead and just rename it pre-K, which is a concept that people already understand.
Yeah.
Instead of having to school them up on what it used to be and how it's been extended to cover everybody. It need not, the T in UTK need not exist anymore. In fact, neither does the U. We can just scrape that, forget about it, leave it as a relic of history, and just call it pre-K now, because that's what it is.
That might be the smartest thing you've ever said.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay. All right. Well, put a pin in that. We'll go ahead and start that cause tomorrow.
But one of the things that Jacob found was that San Diego Unified, just like a lot of school districts in the country, are dealing with enrollment issues and enrollment slowly declining as time goes. There are many reasons for that. But when he took a look at their enrollment numbers, it seemed it still had a decrease, but not as bad as that trend that was going. But it was also because they welcomed a whole new group of children that wouldn't have been enrolled in school in the first place.
Right. Which is, in some ways, it's like, duh.
Yeah.
Like, it used to be available only to people over five,
but and now four
as well. And so,
so our enrollment's not going down.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you also made it possible for a lot more people to go.
But also, you have this new group of children, which also new group of parents, right, who probably would have waited a whole nother year or maybe could have considered their options, but like are now being put in a system where if they do like the system that they're in, will probably stick with that neighborhood school or whatever school they chose to enter. Hence, like, people will start staying in those neighborhood schools, which some people choose to choice out of.
Yeah, either to charter schools or because San Diego Unified has a pretty robust choice program that allows people, wherever you're districted into, to try to go to another San Diego Unified school through a yearly process.
But it's like starting to build a relationship with the school early of, you know, that they set up their their UTK program really well. I'm really liking the school. I'm building relationships. My kid's liking the teachers there. We're just going to stay with the school instead of, you know,
he actually found some people that were going through that.
He found one person who I think they were choosing to go with public school anyway. And I think for them, the choice was that they wanted their child to experience a school that was in their neighborhood. And then also, they wouldn't be paying for a private school. They had their child enrolled in a private school. So it's saving, it was like $15,000 or something.
Yeah. That's, I mean, that's
big savings.
Yeah. I mean, that's my family. It's a profound savings to be able to go to school instead of pay for preschool. Now, some of that savings is given away because I need to pay for after school care, which there's not enough of in the public school system. But I mean, I immediately thought of with Jacob's story was something that I remember Richard Barrera saying for years, Richard Barrera, school board member, for years as San Diego Unified dealt with its plan to improve neighborhood schools, to increase enrollment and to make neighborhood schools competitive with the choice program or with charter schools, was the district's biggest problem wasn't that the schools weren't good enough, but that it was a messaging, a marketing, a communications problem that they needed to persuade parents in those neighborhood school districts that the school was in fact good enough to stay. The school already had achieved the level it needed to achieve. They just hadn't gotten that message through to enough parents for it to trickle down. And as I was thinking about how that played out here, where like now maybe you get a better opportunity than ever before to communicate that quality that you think you've achieved to parents, because parents that may have, you know, been theoretically receptive to that message but never would have gone through with it because they would have taken an opportunity to go to a charter school or to choice to a school that has a better reputation. Well, if your choice is go to the TK in your school or don't, you know, go or
yeah,
stay,
save this money,
save,
or don't.
Save this money or don't. Well, you go ahead, you save the money, you move into TK. Well, then you've got a 1 year period with that, with like a line of communication to that parent to say, isn't this great? Aren't you having a good experience? And
you hope, right? Because
right.
And you had a good experience and others do, could also work the other way.
And Jacob wrote about that too, that like, this is true. This is all well and good insofar as it goes well. Mm-hmm. But if the experience is a negative one, it'll do the exact opposite. It'll, and especially if it's like the transitional kindergarten program is new, and in some places, because it's new, it may feel chaotic or not fully realized yet. And so it might have the exact opposite effect. It may persuade people that their impulse to pursue charter schools or choicing into a school with a better reputation was exactly the right one, and they might flee that neighborhood school. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, I'll say we live right across the street from Einstein Charter School. And so that, like, when I wake up in the morning and I hear kids laughing and they're going to school, they're going to Einstein. That is like in the concept of a neighborhood school, that doesn't mean like the school you're districted into. It means the school in your neighborhood. That one for me is Einstein. Mm-hmm. And so like the impulse that of the woman that Jacob talked to, who said, you know, I want my kid to walk to the school and mm-hmm. to play there and to have that neighborly relationship, like that is attractive to us too. And we would have considered Einstein for that reason. But it wasn't an option. We went to transitional kindergarten at Golden Hill Elementary, which is just a short walk away. And the experience has been so good that it would be odd at this point for us to consider leaving. Because
whereas before, you might have considered your options for another year.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, I think that the way that the school district is thinking about it, you know, at least in my very limited sample of one experience, makes perfect sense. I think if there are a lot of people having a similar experience to me out there, I think it could be a bit of a wind in the back of the district in their attempts to blunt the education enrollment problem. Mm-hmm.
But it could also hurt them if right. it's a bad experience.
Right. I mean, and there's a lot of elementary schools, right? Like every single one of them, just like every single elementary school is a different experience yeah. in any grade. The TK system could be completely different.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how that happens. Also, if the state ever does face a budget crisis, where will this survive that?
Yeah.
You know, so we'll be tracking that as we go forward. But yes, Jacob's doing a great job. You can follow his work every other week with the Learning Curve, his newsletter that comes out, vosd.org/learningcurve. That's vosd.org/learningcurve. Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast in San Diego that is supported by the 3,000 plus of you all who make this possible. Thank you again for the financial contributions you showed and made last week and month. If you missed the cutoff, of course, you don't have to worry about it. You can do and donate again anytime at vosd.org/podpeople, vosd.org/podpeople. If you want to keep up with everything about the podcast, you can do that at vosd.org/pod and sign up for our weekly newsletter there. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and Editor-in-Chief at Voice San Diego. Andrew Keats, the Managing Editor. Andrea Lopez-Villafana is also managing editor, and Nate Johns, our producer. We'll talk to you next week. Thank you.